the night, we got them a lunch of pancakes or rolled cakes, so they'd have something to eat at noon. And that evening then, they wanted us to stay and get the evening meal for them. Well, that was my first attempt at cooking outside over a fireplace, and also Mrs. Taylor's first attempt. But we managed to get something for the men to eat that night. And they fixed a bed for us right along by the side of the horses that they had taken in there. And the horses kept stomping and chewing and stomping and trying to fight the flies all night long. So we didn't get very much sleep. But the next morning, they wanted us to continue on and take care of the men we had.
How many did you have?
We had about 10 or 15 that we were trying to fix for them. And they had their own provisions, but we had to take care of the provisions and the cooking. By the way, it took me years to like potatoes. I cooked so many potatoes in water buckets over the fire. I didn't like potatoes for a long, long time after that.
Well, were you prepared to go on with them? You didn't have your clothing and all your belongings.
No, we just borrowed you what we had and got along for
a little knapsack
time being, because they had to keep on working and going fire. They had Nan. What was your name? Johnny. He was a man here in town that we knew of that was a cook, and he had gone on the firefighting crew just for the experience and was a cook. And they left him up on the top of what was called the Freeze-Out Ridge when they camped there the night before coming on to our cabin. And they left him up there, and he said that he would pack things and have everything all ready, and that the crew coming through could pick them up, and that he'd cut across country and come over to this part of the country. But Johnny missed the packers, and Johnny missed everything when he started out across country. And he got lost, and so he just kept traveling. He said he thought he'd find something sometime. He finally landed in the camp, but by that time they needed firefighters so bad that Johnny wasn't allowed to cook. He was put on the firefighting, and Mrs. Durham and I continued cooking. Well, then they brought in a team what were they called? They were short-termers.
You told me about that. Yeah.
From that you Montana. Told
me. Right.
They had a camp right next to ours, but they had their own cook. And finally, Mr. Roach gave Mrs. Taylor and me a man and a flunky to help us out, so we didn't have quite so much work to do after that. But at any rate, Johnny was put on the firing line.
How long did you cook for the Bayon?
Huh?
How long did you cook for them?
We cooked for over 40 days. We got the government paid us for a little over 40 days for our service for the firefighters. Well, I don't know, it was $40-something. It was about $1 a day, I think.
What did you think of the experience at the time? At the time, what did you think of that?
It was just experience, that was all. Always something new coming up, something that you weren't expecting, like the fire. And one morning it was so smoky outside, after a perfectly still night, and then the smoke would drop down with the I suppose it was the dampness of the evening that the smoke would drop down. And I heard a noise out on the clearing near Mrs. Calkins' cabin. And I got up, and Mrs. Taylor said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to see what the racket is." And so I got up and put on my robe and went outside and took my gun. I had a revolver along with me. And I took my gun and went outside, and just at the edge of the clearing on the other side was a beautiful little deer. I never had shot at a deer. I'd eaten the meat and loved it. So I thought, oh gee, that would be good to have some meat. So I took old Betsy and aimed at the deer. Well, about that time, the gun began to go this way and this way and this way and this way and up and down and up and down. And I got buck fever and I couldn't shoot. I couldn't shoot at that deer. I just had buck fever too bad. So I missed the deer and I went back into the cabin and stayed there. Finally got over my buck fever.
Is buck fever what happens when you try to shoot a deer?
Yes.
That's when you get the shakes.
You get buck fever. That is your nervousness. Your entire nervous and the nerves of your body are all out of control. And
I
your gun,
buck fever.
Your gun arm means nothing. It just go one way or the other. I tried holding it with both hands and it didn't work. Or anything, so I just turned around finally.
Sam, did she ever tell you the final chapter of this Mr. Roach?
Yes, I think
when
so.
When she was over on
yes.
Up from Pierce.
Yes, he apologized.
Yes,
he was sorry.
I forgot.
I was going to ask you, when you were on that fire cooking, did you ever have to move the camp to get away from the fire?
Not exactly. We were camped on one side of the river, and they decided that that was a poor place for our camp. There was a more level place across on the other side. So they fixed up the fireplace on the other side and moved our camp over. Well, the firefighters were all out on the line, and one day there was a heavy wind came up, and we noticed that the men were beginning to come in off of the fire line, both at our camp and at the other camp, the Montana camp across the line. And we wanted to know what, and they said, "Well, this is as nearly a clear place as there is from here up to where the fire line is." And they said there's no way of stopping it with this wind. And he said, "Well, what do we do?" And they said, "There's only one thing to do that we can tell. That's to take your blankets and go down to the stream. And if the fire comes close, get into the water and cover your head with a blanket, leaving an airspace, and stay until the fire has passed over. It may be awfully hot, but if you're in the water, you possibly could survive anyway. That'd be the only way of doing it." So that's what the two men that they left for Lackey Boys with us, and the men that had drifted back, all got their blankets, and we went down to the stream. And we sat there on a log at the edge of the stream and watched the fire coming. Well, somewhere, while we were sitting there, somewhere along, nature took a funny little quirk, and a wind began coming from the other direction and forced the fire back. And it was within a very short distance of where we were camped there at the creek. But it forced the fire back the other way, and it didn't come into our little corner of the woods. So we were very fortunate that time. I thought I'd said goodbye to everybody.
We did too. My
father went out to Clarkia and tried his best to get McPeak or someone to give him a horse and let him go out to our cabin. He wanted to know what had happened to us. He hadn't heard from us, and he didn't know what had happened to us. And he had a daughter out there somewhere, and the men wouldn't give him a horse. They wouldn't allow him to leave Clarkia. He had to stay there at Clarkia and get word if he could. But he stayed there at Clarkia for a few days, but they couldn't get any word from us because of the fire cut that he cut across.
When she came home, she was wearing these filthy, dirty, khaki clothes. Her hair was singed, her eyebrows were kind of moth-eaten, and her face was
beautiful,
kind of, and a revolver around her waist, and she came clumping up the street. And we'll be glad to see her.
Oh, dear. Well, I started to tell you, this man, actually, Jay Roach.
You told him that, Ione.
Huh?
You told him that. About Pierce.
About what?
About meeting him at Pierce.
Oh.
She told
you.
Meeting him at Pierce. But while we were on the fire line up there, Ashley J. Roach was taken from the heat of the summer and all the responsibilities of the fire and the firemen and all, and he got a very severe case of diarrhea, of summer diarrhea. And he came back into camp looking like a lost sheep. I never saw anybody look like he did. And I said, "What's the trouble?" And he told me. And I said, "Well, I can't go myself because I have to stay and help Mrs. Taylor get something for your men to eat tonight. But if you will give me a man by the name of Ricketts," which I knew here in Moscow, I knew his wife and Jack Ricketts, I said, "I'll tell him where to get some medicine in my cabin, and I'll send him back to the cabin and get something which I think will help you." Well, my father, being a doctor, had given us all kinds of every medicine that he thought we would possibly use, and I knew where it was and what it was. And when he found Ricketts, and I sent Ricketts back to the cabin, and Ricketts got some clean clothes for me and some clean clothes for Mrs. Taylor on his trip, and the medicine for A.J. Roach. Well, A.J. Roach took it, and within a short time was able to get back on the firing line again and take
sure
it off.
You sure were nice to him.
Yeah, you were pretty nice to him, considering that he wasn't very nice to you.
No, he wasn't, but then the man was in trouble, and he had to have help, and I had the means of giving it to him, so I got it for him.
What did you think of him, though?
What did I think of him?
Yes.
I didn't think very much of him, but I had to respect him because he was at the head of the camp and all, and any disrespect should not have been given to him because he was doing the job he was given to do, although he was not trained for it. But he was doing the best he could. But I didn't like him. I didn't like him at all.
Now, what's your next question?
If the homesteaders had been able to prove up on those places, would they have sold to the lumber company after
yes.
it was proved up?
The lumber companies were in this part of the country, all through that section of the country, Clarkia and the meadow country and beyond, and from there clear on up into Avery. They were buying the timber from these homesteaders, and those that were allowed to prove up sold their places. But those the others lost it and lost their time and lost the money that it took to do their improving and all.
Would there have been a pretty good profit for the people who had proved up
they
if they had been
so
able to?
They thought so at that time. most of the people out there would get all the way from $3,000 to $8,000, depending upon the stand of timber on the particular location. And some of them got along very nicely. This Elsie File, I just don't remember rightly whether she sold hers or whether she lost it.
I think she lost it.
She lost it.
I think so.
Mrs. Brown, Della Brown Griffith, had a claim right close to Mrs. File, and I think that she got her claim. Some of them did in that location, and some didn't. Remember me telling you about dynamite being at our door? When Carter got back, he said that, a man by the name of Fleming came in. Myrtle and I had been out to Moscow to see Mrs. Durham when she was in the hospital, and Carter took us out, but Carter had some other business on hand and didn't want to take us back. And so my father called Avery and found that there was a man there by the name of Fleming, A.J. Fleming, from Canada, that knew that section of the country and the trail and would be glad to take us back to the homestead. And that's the way we got back to the homestead, was by Fleming taking us. But Fleming and Dynamite over at the boys' cabin, Dynamite was staying with Hansen and Larson, and they decided they wanted something to read. And they knew that Mrs. Brown had left a lot of reading material at her cabin, so they decided that they would go over and get some of this material and bring it over to us so that we'd have something to read likewise. Well, when they went to investigating the cabin, they found phonograph records, and we had one of these little tiny Ford, the first little phonographs with
his
a long
voice.
Morning glory horn and all. We had one of those, and so they saw these records over there and decided that they'd bring us some records, so they brought over a load of records for us. We had a great time playing those records we hadn't heard before, and they brought the magazines for us. And Fleming spent two nights or three nights there with us and
Dynamite. Was he the one that liked his liquor?
Huh?
Was he the one that liked liquor? Of course, it was taboo for the girls.
Yeah.
And one of these two men, when he was taking them out on the back to where they were going, as they were crossing a little bridge, he looked down and said, "Well, there's a bottle of liquor we should take." They knew perfectly well he stashed it there. He had it.
He climbed down over off of the bridge and down onto the bottle. Picked it up, the bottle had never been opened. Somebody had lost a bottle of liquor. And he picked it up.
I thought that was pretty smart.
And he said, "We'll just take it with us. We might need it." Well, he was just getting over a St. Patrick's Day and booze up there. He'd been drunk for quite a while, but the man at the office said that he was all right, that he knew the country, and that he was over it sufficient, that he could take us back. And, well, we picked up the bottle of liquor, and he started to put it in his bag, in his knapsack. And I said, "AJ, I think I'd like that." And he turned around and gave me a look and handed me the bottle. Well, I put the bottle in my knapsack then and carried it. I thought, "Well, you don't get any unless you take me with it." Well, we got to the cabin, where the government cabin, our halfway cabin between Avery and the homestead, And
that was just a lean-to, wasn't it? Just bows put up to keep the rain off you? There's no cabin.
Oh, yes, it was just a lean-to. It wasn't a cabin. It was just a lean-to, a three-sided lean-to with a roof over it. And you built your fire out in front of it, and the heat come in to supposedly to keep you warm. It did, but it also melted the snow on the roof, and the water dropped down your back in the middle of the night and scared the life out of you. But at any rate, we reached the cabin, or got about a mile and a half out from the cabin. AJ's, spiel with liquor, caught up with him. And he got to the point that he just couldn't carry his knapsack any longer. It was too heavy. So Myrtle and I divided the knapsack and put it on our backs and helped AJ as nearly as we could till we got to the lean-to. Well, he curled up at the lean-to for a little while, and we gathered up a little kindling. Everyone that was supposed to use a lean-to was supposed to leave kindling enough or wood enough for the following person to use. And we started a fire outside and got AJ next to the fire and got him sort of thawed out a little bit. And I said, would you like a drink? And he said he would love it. So Myrtle and I mixed up, got some hot water from the vessels there, and we fixed up a drink for each of us, making it light, but with heat and the liquor was enough that Fleming soon got through enough that he could get up and get firewood enough to keep us for the night. And he sat out with the fire and kept things going, and we sat inside the lean-to and fought the water dripping. But in the morning, we all got up and had our breakfast and started on to the cabin. We got through the night all right.
Maybe it was finding that liquor was a good thing.
A.J. Fleming was a remittance man from Canada. He had been shipped over from England and was a remittance man from Canada and came down into that section of the country and just traveled around to get acquainted with the country. So he knew the country he was going into. In the meantime, he had gone down into Michigan somewhere. I don't know just where, but Mrs. Borah and Mrs. Bush, that's Mrs. William Borah, and Mrs. Bush had gone to this resort and were spending a few days at the resort. And it happened to be the time that A.J. Fleming came down from Canada, and he got acquainted with them. So when he came in and said that he knew Mrs. Borah and they knew Mrs. Bush, and it also helped to give us something that we could rely on, and we felt very much better about A.J. Fleming after that. He was a funny man. He wrote poetry, and he could spiel off poetry by the yards. I have a poem, I think I still have it in the basement, that he wrote about the homesteaders out there, and he write part of it with his left hand and part of it with his right hand. And it looks so funny to see the two different handwritings on this poem.
Were they any good?
Huh?
Were the poems any good?
Oh yes, they were good.
What is a remittance man?
I thought again? You were gonna ask that.
What is a remittance man?
Oh, it is a man that doesn't conform with the way of life in England, and the family are practically ashamed of him. And so in order to get him out of the way, they send him over to Canada.
Which pay him so much a month or a year.
As a British subject, he would be acceptable in Canada. And he was accepted in Canada. He had been in one of the wars and had a very deep scar across his forehead here and up into his hairline. That we asked him once, so he said, "I suppose you're wondering where I got that scar," and we said, "Yes." So he told us that it was during such and such a war, and that he was wounded in the war, but other than the scar was all that he had that showed that he wasn't. And that's why they call them remittance men. They pay for them.
The parents do? Mm-hmm.
The parents or their relatives pay for them to stay out of England, where they are ashamed to have him known as a cousin of so-and-so, or the Earl's oldest brother, or something like that. But
I wonder what you had to do to get kicked out of your own country like that. Maybe it wouldn't take too
maybe
much.
Maybe that scar wasn't from the war. Maybe he got into trouble.
He may have had something besides a war scar. I don't know. It could have been a war scar, but we had to take his word for it.
Well, it sounds as though your father was interested in having protection for you, and the other women too were would rely on outside help. But did they have to rely? Would you have been able to rely on yourself and in tight spots too?
We did.
We hired men to come in and clear up the clearing and the buildings and put up the buildings for us. We hired a great deal of our labor from the men at Clark Hill. We had one man by the name of Courtemarche, a Frenchman, and the other was named Al Champagne.
That's interesting news.
And Al Champagne was the brother of the wife of the man that owned the big saloon in in Clark Hill. His name was Champagne, and Al Champagne was one of them. So we had those two men. They got wood for us, and Carter would get wood if we needed any. But these men, in cutting down the old trees and clearing up on the, put the woodshed full of wood, so that we had no trouble with the wood at all.
Did you have to have a certain amount of clearing other than for protection?
Yes, you were supposed to have a certain amount of clearing and gardening and any other, improvements that belong on a home. I had to have a barn. I didn't have a horse, but I had to have a barn, which I used for the woodshed and all.
Was the 22 months that you were there, was that in a row, continuous?
Yes, with the exception of the time I took off and went to
the trial.
To Wallace. One week I took off, about the 1st of March, and Mrs. Durham was here at the hospital at that time, and Myrtle and I came out with Carter and decided to come on down to Moscow and see how the mother was getting along and to be out in civilization for a little while. And they were gardening out here on over the South Hill Road. People were gardening along in there, and the vegetables were coming up, and you could see them. That was in March of that year. And it seemed awfully good to see all this land.
But they're giving that land to the railroads. Would that be sort of like eminent domain? Is that what they call it? They just go through and take property because they need it for a highway or something?
Is that what happened?
I think
did the railroad just get the land?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
that it, the government just gave them certain sections of land in order to get this country opened up. And I don't know what they ever expected to do
that's
with the land.
That's the way Southern Pacific, the New Pacific got so wealthy.
If your
railroad rights was what it
was. If your land, if your homestead had not been on the government, I mean on the railroad land, mm-hmm. would they have left you alone?
I presume so, but I don't know because they tackled so many of the others that...
So it might have been either way.
It.
They might have gotten you one
anyway. I couldn't tell how that would have been decided.
I remember, I think I do correctly, you were saying something about stolen timbers. There was a discussion of that too. Was it a stolen timber claim or something that they wanted?
Yes, but that was down here on the Ruby Creek out from Beauville.
What's a stolen timber?
It wasn't the same thing.
Did you take up two homesteads?
Hmm?
Did you have two homesteads?
This was a stone and timber down here. And I filed on that.
You were filing.
I had the two sections.
Did you get to prove up on the stone and timber?
Huh?
Did you get the stone and timber?
Yes,
land?
I did in a way. This is funny. The Potlatch, I had this, it's on Ruby Creek out from Beauville.
It had a
between
mine.
Beauville and Elk River on that line across there. And the Potlatch Lumber Company were